Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And what a treat this week to meet Noel Tyrrell. Noel is a radio enthusiast. He is founder of the David Hamilton's Hotshots fan site, which you can find on Facebook. And he is someone who has an encyclopedic knowledge and collection of vintage radio shows. Now, Noel grew up with radio, and we learn why the person who awakened his interest was Diddy David Hamilton. We talk about why Junior Choice was so special and whether the sort of radio presenting that Ed Stewart, my own radio hero, and David Hamilton epitomised is in the ascendance anymore. We also find out why David Hamilton is nicknamed One Take Hamilton. Noel talks about what it was like to meet his radio heroes. And we hear about the time that Noel was at the supermarket checkout and who should ring to apologise for not playing Val Dunigan's Paddy McGinty's Goat just a few days earlier on Christmas Junior Choice, but Ed Stewart himself. Noel talks about what was so clever about the Jimmy Young show and how we could never work out what JY's political sympathies were. We discuss Jimmy Young's previous incarnation as a crooner, and we learn what Noel thinks about his successor, Jeremy Vine. Both of Noel's parents were actors, and it was through them that he met many showbiz types. Noel talks about Simon D, and we find out why Noel would categorise himself as a frustrated journalist. We learn why Noel so enjoys disseminating David Hamilton's Boom radio show on social media, and writing a synopsis, and a very good one at that, of each programme. Noel explains why he is a sounding board for David Hamilton, and we find out whether Noel himself would be interested in doing a radio show of his own. He tells us why radio plays are better than their TV counterparts, why radio he thinks will far outlast TV, and why radio is so wonderful because one can listen to it while on the move. We learn whether Noel is a looking back or looking forward type of person. We learn what he thinks about Benny Hill and Talking Pictures TV, and why he respects things for the period in which they were made. It was an absolute pleasure for this week's nostalgia interview to catch up with Noel Tyrrell. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Noel Tyrrell for my latest nostalgia interview. And Noel, as I was saying to you when we were speaking before we started the recording, I've been so fascinated by the assiduous way in which you've been putting together so many materials through Retro Radio, for example, and the David Hamilton site that you run on Facebook, which is so redolent in radio nostalgia.
Well, I grew up with radio. I date back to the days of the Light program when I was very much a small child, of course. But I think the person who really awakened my interest in radio was David Hamilton. I can remember in the afternoons when I was fielding at cricket, I was never very good at games, and I was always looking for something to pass the time. So I'd take my tranny with me, transistor radio, I think we have to call it these days. And I'd be listening to Radio One, and of course the David Hamilton show, and he's appealed. His whole presentation and the way that he presented radio appealed to me. He seemed to take a huge interest in the music that he was playing. He had a great way of talking to the people that were in those days writing into his show, because there was no internet or anything then, and he took a real interest in his listeners. And he also had a wonderful sense of humour and a witty repartee. But it was very different to many of the others, and that isn't any criticism of the Radio 1 DJs at the time. But I suppose when David went to Radio 2, I went with him. Even at that tender age, I was probably a little bit Radio 2. But it was David who really introduced me to radio, and I've been listening to him ever since.
And I think so many people have a very similar kind of story, because there's going to be somebody who at a young age really tends to encapsulate something that at a particular time and place in your life, and it may have been Saturday or Sunday morning with Ed Stewart on Junior Choice, where you kind of felt, first of all, the enthusiasm of the presenter, and what you say about David Hamilton is palpable, and of course David is still very much going strong, well into his 80s. But what I think is so fascinating about certain presenters, and Stew Pop being perhaps the obvious one in my case, is that you kind of feel that even if they weren't being paid to do the job, you know, they would do this because it's their vocation. And the if you're young, if you're 7 or 8 years of age, and in an age when we didn't have the internet, we didn't have social media, but the way to connect with people was through radio, to have a request played or to have an excerpt that you'd recorded and taken the trouble to put onto a cassette tape and sent to the BBC and have it played on the radio and to have your name and the friends that you know and family members all shared, maybe while your parents are still in bed on a Saturday morning, this is your zone. And all those decades later, the way that Radio 2 brought Junior Choice back in 2007, it kind of feels that there's something magical about radio that I've never encountered from social media, all-encompassing and universal though it is.
Yeah, I think that Junior Choice program was very, very special. I mean, Ed inherited it from one or two people. I think Uncle Mac was the first to do it on the Light program. But Ed made it his own. And as I've said all along the line, you know, on many occasions when he got that Sunday afternoon show so many years later, it was basically Junior Choice for adults. But nobody did a request program the same way as Ed did. And as you rightly say, he made it feel so special for those people that, you know, in those days they'd stick a, you know, C60 in their tape machine and they would record their request to Ed. I mean, there's a wonderful one that's still there about he's making a request for this young boy making a request for his sister because every Saturday morning, apparently, she used to wash his hair for him. It sounds a very odd and strange thing to me, but the way Ed put it across, it wasn't. And it was so special. And I don't quite know what the record was. I can't remember what the record was. But everything that Ed did in those shows, those Junior Choice shows, made it a unique listen. And I think people have remembered it for their lifetimes. Those kids that grew up in the 70s, they still remember those requests that Ed put out on Junior Choice. Of course, when it came back in 2007, it got huge. I think it was the biggest rating show, and it was live. I think the first one or two they may have recorded. But Ed said, no, I don't want to record this. I'm a live radio man. I want to do it live. And then, of course, when he did do it live, it just worked. It was a recreation, and everybody loved it. And I think it was probably the biggest rating show on radio, Christmas radio, because people took the trouble to listen. And they knew there was all that recorded stuff coming out in the afternoon. Yeah. Shows about ABBA and, you know, American pop stars doing it. But Ed was live, and it was 1976 all over again.
And what really stood out, I think, in that is that it was, as you say, a Sunday morning, and suddenly everybody was transported back to the 1970s. And people who were now grandparents, so they were children when they wrote into the programme first time around, and there's the presenter with the same infectious enthusiasm doing it, but playing the same records, but for grown-ups this time. And actually, you've just reminded me of going to university in 1991, and I don't know if you remember, but I think Judith Chalmers had just finished the morning slot that Ken Bruce had been doing and then returned to a few months later. And they had these stand-in presenters, and one of them actually was Nanette Newman. The other, Mark Winter, of course, famous for, you know, but Venus and Blue Jeans. And Ed Stewart did it for a month, and he was the seg between, would have been Derek Jameson and Jimmy Young. But he was playing all the Nelly the Elephant, and it was Junior Choice for, it, also it was a kind of sort of a mix between Junior Choice, Housewives Choice. But it did feel, and it was live radio, and this was somebody who had, and you know, Tony Blackburn has it very much, David Hamilton absolutely has it, but just that sense of being in control of the equipment and control of, you know, they know the remit of the job. And if something fails, if the record doesn't play, then actually they up their game rather than think, oh, it's all gone wrong, this is terrible. They're masters at what they do. And suddenly, of course, because they're communicating to an audience and they get the audience, then they can convince the listeners that, of course, this is, they're going to steer them, you know, to a happy denouement. You know, it's all going to go very smoothly. And I think that
brand of radio presenter, I think, is sadly really not really in ascendance anymore.
No, I don't think so. I think probably Ken Bruce, obviously David, he's, you know, had a renaissance. He's back on national radio, and it's quite incredible. I mean, he's going to be 83 on Friday, but he sounds as good now as he ever did before, and his brain is as sharp as a pin. As you say, those were radio men. They were steeped in it. It was a natural instinct to them. I mean, I know there was a strike, I think it was around about 1979, it affected television, it affected radio, and the plug was pulled. I mean, it was like a wildcat strike. The plug was pulled. Yeah. The only people that they could rely upon were people like David Hamilton that came in and actually kept some kind of continuity. And of course, continuity was something that he was involved with as well, but some kind of continuity going during the strike. And he has been known as one take Hamilton. You know, they knew that they could rely upon David, whether it be radio or television. He doesn't need a second take. He knows exactly what to say. He knows exactly what to do. It's totally natural with him. He's brilliant at it. And I think Ed was very much out of the same mold. And I think those old guys like Jimmy Young and obviously Terry Wogan as well. It was something, all those people that were brought up in the late 30s and 40s, or were born in the late 30s and 40s, who came to radio after the days of the light program, where they were kind of, you know, I mean, it was all, the light program was starting to give the public popular music. I think probably had the Pirates came along later, and a lot of people attribute, you know, pop radio to the Pirates. But it was a light program that started to realize that there was demand for rock and roll. And there was that metamorphosis between the music of the 50s and then the rock and roll. And then, of course, the very, very radical music of the 60s and the Beatles and all the rest of it. And of course, David went along with that and was part of that. And the same, I would say, with people like Terry Wogan and Ed Stewart, etc. They were all of the same. Some of them were pirates. Some of them were announcers. Some of them had been the television background. But they were incredibly talented people that were able to actually carry the new media. And that's what it was. It was a new media to everybody. Pop radio, nobody had ever heard of it before. But it was coming. It was on its way. And it was growing. It grew through the Pirates. And then, of course, into the phenomenon that was Radio 1. And for the first 10 years, Radio 1 just secured the market. They hadn't, obviously, there was no competition to them. But if they hadn't laid down those deep, deep foundations, I don't think that we would see radio as we see it today. And amongst those pioneers were people like David.
And of course, in later years, Noel, you met David, and of course, you're close friends with him. And I think I'm a little envious, actually, in some ways, because, you know, I so wish I'd got to meet some of those radio heroes. In some cases, I still might, of course, but I think I told you the story once before about how, in the case of Ed Stewart, I was working on a book on Christmas as part of my work, and there's a chapter on Junior Choice, and I did think on the day that it was. That I received the prints of the proofs from the publisher. I thought, I wonder what Ed Stewart would make of this. And I thought, then again, you know, what if I sent it, or, you know, I didn't hear back, or, you know, because obviously he's used to people writing in saying, can you play Nelly the Elephant or My Old Man's a Dustman? But here's me writing a book about the programme. Anyway, and in my mind, I thought, well, maybe I will. And then later that evening, I heard that he'd passed away. So this would have been at the beginning of January 2016. And I just kind of felt then, I really wish I'd had the opportunity to meet him, because he sounded such an amiable and passionate presenter. But of course, you did know Ed Stewart. And also, of course, David Hamilton is somebody that you've met. And so what is it like to meet your radio heroes?
Well, if they don't disappoint you, it's great. And neither of those guys did. I think, you know, where Ed was concerned, I know that if you had got in touch with him, about the piece that you were writing, I know that Ed would have given me some feedback and some response, because that's the type of guy that he was. I mean, David was, he had a house in Barnes, in Queen's Ride in Barnes, for many years. And it was a place that had a kind of history, because an awful lot of radio and showbiz people, obviously, over the years, came to be entertained or spent pleasant times with David there. And I think his time was coming to primetime radio, where he had been for several years, unfortunately, was coming to an end. And I think David felt that it was time to move out of London. And of course, he moved into his house that he now lives in Sussex. And there's an extraordinary story behind that as well, in that it actually turned out to be the very house that he spent his time during the war. He's evacuated from the war and he spent his time with his grandfather in this very farmhouse that he now lives in. He had a final party at Queen's Ride in Barnes. And obviously, Ed Stewart was there. And he was telling me that he was going to be doing his Junior Choice show live a couple of days later. It was just before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And my young daughter, Ellie, was there. She was about 3 or 4 years old. He said, I'd love to do a request for Ellie. And it was a very genuine offer, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, could you do Paddy McGinty's Goat, which I'm not sure was a great choice, to be honest. But anyway, he said, no. He said, I will. I'll make a note of it.
Yeah. And there was a story that you told me about being at the Tesco checkout. And this to me is like, this is like a film sequence when you're about to pay for your groceries and the phone rings and it's Ed Stewart on the other end of the line.
Exactly. Well, this is the point, because when the show actually came along, he was obviously carried along as he would be with a live radio show. And he put Ellie's request sort of probably what was originally at the top of the pile, but he got to the bottom of the pile. Yeah. And there was only so many records that he could play, and the emails are coming in and all the rest of it. Anyway, he didn't play it. Yeah. I'm a bit disappointed at the time, not that Ellie really cared, because she was 3 years old, but to me, I felt a little bit disappointed, but I thought, oh, yeah, I understood the circumstances. Yeah. And as you rightly say, 2 days later, I was at the checkout at Tesco, and my phone rang, and it was Ed. And he said, no, I really did have to call you and let you know, and just say to you, I am so sorry that I didn't get around to Ellie's request, and explained the very circumstances that I knew had, you know, befallen him, that he wasn't in a position to. But the fact that he actually took the trouble to do that, it says so much about Ed, and also his professionalism and the way that, you know, he dealt with everything in his life.
And of course, the link with David Hamilton, I've got a recording. I think actually you probably put it up, but it would have been Radio Sussex. I'm guessing it would have been around 2014. And he was sitting in for David Hamilton one afternoon. And it was a live radio show. And I think Ed, the only other live radio he was doing in those days, of course, was on Radio 2 on Christmas Day. And he had a few guests on the programme. I think at one point there was even a film link. I know the date. It was the 30th of June, because it was the song that, you know, The Last Day of June by Bobby Goldsborough. And he was making a joke about that. And somehow I just sort of listened to that programme and I thought, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's, and you know, because I'm not necessarily part of that generation, because I you know, don't remember David on Radio 2, for example, because I would have been only about 13 when he finished doing the afternoons. But there's something about that particular generation of presenters, and many of them are still working, some of them perhaps on national radio, but many of them are not. But I'm just sort of thinking, in your case, and having got to know David as well over the years, is there something about that particular generation that kind of means that someone like yourself, who curates their shows and has them, you know, is the way in the future? We're just going to be listening to lots of recordings of shows that were recorded 20, 30 years ago, because in some ways you're never going to have anything replicated today that, you know, that sort of speaks to the audience or the same type of audience in anything resembling the same way anymore.
Well, yeah, it's tempting to say yes. I think probably one has to give a current radio a chance as well. There is a local radio station here. It's called Wave. They broadcast out of Portsmouth or something like that. And their presenters are actually kind of along the same lines. Certainly not as, I don't wish to be critical, but you know, the global radio presenters and the way that radio is done there, where they have a very narrow playlist. I think it's what they would call voice tracked. It's all kind of pre-recorded, etc. And it doesn't really sound like the sort of radio that was being produced in those glory days. So I think there are probably a few radio stations, but there are very few independent radio stations that are left. They've all been sucked into this huge conglomerate. And I mean, obviously, I think Heart have a breakfast program, which actually is quite good. Is it Jamie Theakston? Is it Amanda Holden? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But I've listened to bits of that. That's quite good. I'm not entirely sure that I like the music that they play, but you know, it's like my thoughts on Radio 2. I mean, Radio 2 has had to move, it's had to evolve. It does have a demographic of sort of 35 to 50. And that's always going to be the same, isn't it, really? And I think there will be people who fall off the other end, and there will be people who are ready to join at the beginning as well. So, I mean, I think that's, you have to accept that time travels. We all get older, new people come along. So I'm not that hugely critical of Radio 1. Radio 2. But at the same time, I think it's very, very sad that that radio has ignored what is the boom generation. And David is now on boom radio, and people are sitting up and looking around and realizing that actually these guys, they're not professional old people. They're just the same as, you know, they've just got a little bit, you know, time has moved on. Obviously, they have their taste in music, but they're still relevant. You know, they're still going to, you know, produce advertising revenue and all the rest of it. And boom, David Lloyd and Paul Robey have seen this and realized this, and they've had the guts to do something about it. Very, very brave move, backed by Mr. Riley. And it seems at the moment to be a huge success. And I think the BBC had the opportunity to, I know they're not a commercial channel, but they should be looking after their license holders. They should be looking after their license holders, whether they be, you know, 35 to 50 or whether they be 50 to 75, 80, whatever. I think they have failed the older generation.
There's certainly an irony, and I think it comes down to some degree to perception that, you know, in the 80s, you know, Radio 2 was playing a lot of vintage music that perhaps didn't seem as cutting edge and perhaps didn't appeal to a generation brought up on, you know, the post-rock and roll. It was funny when you were talking about the rock and roll there and music that came before it. And I think I was listening to K-Star's Rock and Roll Waltz the other day, and that kind of sums up that transition sort of in the 1950s from the different modes of music. But what I think is really interesting is that, so in the 1980s and even into the 90s, the perception of Radio 2 is perhaps appealing to a very sort of older demographic. But now the perception is that Radio 2 is very much closer to what Radio 1 was a decade and a half, 2 decades ago, and in some cases playing the same kind of music. So there is a space in between, and I do think that what you say about boom radio is very interesting, because it's kind of created a space that certainly doesn't appear to be, apart from fragments of individual shows and individual presenters, is not there in that sort of systematic way.
Yeah, I do think that radio has missed a trick, really, by disregarding the older generation. And yeah, you are right. I mean, David Hamilton, he left Radio 2, citing the fact that they were playing Max Bygraves records. And, you know, but it wasn't just that. They were playing kind of panpipes and, you know, but I don't think David had too much of a problem with playing, you know, Frank Sinatra and you know, that kind of music, the swing music and that kind of thing. But he did, I think he did have an issue playing, you know, Pink with toothbrush and a blue toothbrush. I mean, it was really, again, the sort of thing that Ed Stewart would have done in Junior Choice in the earlier years. And I think Radio 2 did kind of go down that road. I mean, it's great that when David went to primetime radio, he was starting to, you know, play, as you say, K-Star, those kind of artists, the torch music and that kind of thing. But it was appropriate for the radio that he was there. I don't think he felt it was right for his audience. And the other thing is that I think that there was a kind of divergence. I think in a way, David was helping to carry the Radio 1 audience across by having a show in the afternoon that would play rock and roll, play Motown, play the music that he very much loves and was part of his Radio 1 show earlier on in the 70s. And bearing in mind that we are in the 80s now, we're talking, you know, 35 years ago. But he felt that it was helping to move across, to actually bring that demographic across. And I think that was part of his argument. And I think he left on a matter of principle. And I think I applaud him for that.
Yeah. And the journey for you is one that, as you said, you were 14 years of age and you heard David Hamilton when you were at school. And but radio, by the sound of it, for you, maybe for many of your peers, maybe it was also a generational thing, because radio was huge for me when I was growing up in the late 70s, early 80s. But was radio something that from the very beginning was an instrumental part in your childhood?
Yeah, very much so. I can remember that big speaker on the kitchen wall. Slightly frayed speaker on the kitchen wall. And out of that, I used to hear things like, you know, Housewife's Choice. I think probably the Light Programme. I mean, my father was never really into pop radio. He loved Jimmy Young in his later years, and it was Mr. Angry that used to write in, you know, Jimmy. The great thing about Jimmy was that, and I think Jeremy Vine unfortunately shattered the illusion. Because Jimmy Young never had a listener phone in, you know. He always read the listeners' views and comments. And it worked so well. Because he didn't put his spin on it. He just read it as it was. And you would never have known from the moment that he started broadcasting that program, which is a political base to it, what Jimmy's politics really were. One kind of suspected what his politics were, but you never really knew, because he never let it be known. He and Margaret Thatcher became radio favourites. Would you necessarily know that Margaret Thatcher's politics were the politics of Jimmy Young? No, you would never. You would never. That was why Jimmy was so good at doing that. He was brilliant at it.
Yeah, and I remember hearing the interview. It may have been on Tracks of My Years with Ken Bruce, and Nigel Havers was being interviewed, and it turns out that he used to be an assistant on the programme. And
a researcher.
Researcher. And it was through him, I think, that he managed, or through his family connections, but he managed to bag Margaret Thatcher and get her on. I think she must have been leader of the opposition, perhaps, at the time. Mm. And then, of course, as you say, because in later years, when I started to listen to him, he was well known for those interviews. And he'd interviewed every party leader and certainly every prime minister from, you know, Harold Wilson onwards or whatever, and that was what he was known for. But of course, he was also very well known, of course, in the 1950s as a crooner, as a pop star, and Unchained Melody. And I always remember how surreal it was. It must have been around 2002 when Unchained Melody made it back to the top of the charts for one of the pop idol or whatever it was singers of their day. Was it Will Young or Gareth Gates, whatever?
I think it was Robson and Green.
Yeah,
and it was in the 90s, and they brought that record back into the charts. Yeah. And at the time, Jimmy, of course, he had a field day with that, saying, you know, well, I was. And I think there was an American star, I can't remember his name, but at the particular time, Jimmy actually had the most successful version of Unchained Melody in terms of the chart success. But he's never really had the credit for it, because other people have kind of overshadowed it as they went along. But of course, Jimmy's musical career has again been hugely overshadowed by what he did later on. And that was his conception, as I was saying. The way that he did that show, and going back to my father, he regularly, you know, he would write in, or I think in those days they'd phone up and a researcher would answer the phone. And he would, my father was quite good at being sort of Mr. Angry about this, that or the other. And he would, and Jimmy Young with I've got John Tyrrell from Winchester, I think he was at the time. And there was a couple of other people with regular names that escape me now, but they were regularly calling him. But the way Jimmy put that across with those little kind of sound bites of what his listeners, to me, was so much more effective than when people phone into the Jeremy Vine show now.
I think Jeremy Vine paid Jimmy Young a real compliment, because I remember reading his autobiography a few years ago, and Jeremy Vine said exactly what you've just mentioned there, that, of course, he didn't put the listeners on the air. But these days, in an age when everybody's reading out tweets, then actually what Jimmy Young was doing then could be seen now as quite cutting edge, because it's what everyone's doing now.
Tweets. Absolutely, yeah. And to be fair to Jeremy Vine, who I've never had a great deal of time for, my sister, who was a leading, unfortunately she no longer is, but she was a leading Fleet Street journalist, and it was through her and a column that she was writing on a weekly basis that David first has sort of started to take notice of me, and we got in touch and eventually went out to dinner, and you know, the rest is history. I've lost my thread.
Just about Jeremy Vine and the way in which, so your sister,
my sister went to Jeremy Vine's wedding, but I've always felt slightly, I just felt that Jeremy was slightly a bit too PC in one thing and another, you know, for me. But to be fair, he did a program. He also does a Channel 5 chat show in the mornings. And he had David on a few months ago, back in March, and boom, it ended up going a month. And he was so gracious and so lovely. And so he called David Radio Royalty. That I completely changed. Because don't forget, David goes out at 12 o'clock in tandem, if you like, at the same time as Jeremy Vine. And I'd be putting, you know, I write these sort of appraisals of David's show. I mean, I'd be putting, well, if you don't want the angst, and, you know, you do really want to constantly be hearing about COVID and this, that, the other, listen to David Hamilton. And being quite harsh about Jeremy Vine, and yet he was so lovely. To David, and he went up in my estimation so much. He respected him for what he was, and the background that David has got in radio. Let's face it, you know, a pioneer.
Yeah, I saw that interview. I think actually maybe you'd posted it, and
the
moment that David came on,
maybe putting it on again soon just to refresh people's memory.
Yeah, because the first thing he said was, "Listen to that voice." You know, Jeremy Vine got very excited. He said, "Radio royalty," and I think that he respected that. And I also think that with Jeremy Vine as well, there was an awareness that the transition from JY to JV was not necessarily a smooth one, and he acknowledged that and he understood that. And I thought that he did a really good and very gracious job in his autobiography of trying to work through that Radio 2 needed to change, but there were casualties along the way. But I thought he was very sensitive about that, and the way in which he needed to make sure that that the listeners were prepared to at least give him a chance. And I think you're right. Jeremy Vine certainly went up in my estimation. But other radio greats. I mean, you mentioned that your father was not necessarily a pop music person, but what did your parents do? What sort of childhood memories particularly come to mind?
Well, both my parents were actors. They actually met at the Webber Douglas School of Dramatic Art, a very well-known drama school. I think Graham Norton, many others, went there over the years. And my father progressed from that into running a theatre in Croydon, the Ashcroft Theatre. I've got in my desk here the first night of that theatre opening back in 1962. The opening performance of the Ashcroft Theatre on the evening of November the 5th, 1962, and it was named after Dame Peggy Ashcroft. And the play that was directed by Clement Scott Gilbert. My father does get a mention somewhere along the line. I think he was the stage manager or something. But the play was Royal Gambit, and it starred Michael Denison and Dulcie Gray, who made many, many films in the 1940s. So that was, he went from there to work for the BBC in the copyright department back in the early 60s when they first built the BBC Television Centre. From there, he became a theatrical agent for a while with an agency called Chartwell Artists, who were huge at the time. They used to have people like Frank Sinatra and Mark Bolan and, you know, huge stars on their books. John Alden, I always remember going to, it was actually a polo match in which Eric Sykes and Jimmy Edwards were actually on the polo ponies. Maybe others, but John Alderson came along. He was just going through a divorce with his first wife. Of course, he'd met Pauline Collins. This would have been about 1971, something like that. And so with my background, I got to meet many, many show business people in my childhood, which, you know, was lovely. I mean, I had an extraordinary childhood, really. I went to a prep school and a public school. At my prep school, one of my the other boys at school was a guy called Simon Henty Dodd. Now, I don't know if that's a name that means anything to you, but Simon Henty Dodd's father was Simon D.
Of course.
And Simon D was just starting to kind of, his style was in the ascendancy, really. He was a very difficult man, very difficult to work with. He was a huge star, as you know, in the 1960s. You know, in fact, he was on. He was a pirate radio, a Radio Caroline. He then started to present D-Time, which was his enormous TV show, bigger than when Wogan had it. I mean, it was the original T-Time chat show. Very few editions of that still remain. Most of it went out live. But I can remember Simon D coming to my school in a blue velvet suit, driving a big black Bentley, and we all rushed around to get his autograph. And, you know, it was they were extraordinary times, and the times that I was brought up in, some of the people that I met during the course of my early years.
Yeah. And I think there's a Sounds of the 60s connection, isn't there? Wasn't Simon D the first presenter back in something like 1990 or maybe just before then?
I'm not sure if he was the first presenter, but he was certainly a guest presenter, and he did present it for quite a while. But like anything that Simon did, it never really lasted, unfortunately. I don't know, I think, you know, he'd do something for a while and then that was it. He'd had enough and he'd move on. The last thing I remember hearing Simon D was, funnily enough, I don't know if you remember, but Steve Wright, when he first started to do his afternoon show, he tried to recreate the round table. Do you remember the round table? It was originally presented by Roscoe. And then I think Kid Jensen took it over. And David Hamilton took part in quite a lot of those round tables. Mine's recorded. I put some recordings on there. I've got recordings of it. But it was quite a good feature. And I'm surprised that Steve Wright didn't keep it going. But anyway, he didn't. But anyway, on a Friday afternoon, he was bringing in various people. And I remember on one occasion, in came Simon D. They played, was it George, that guy Baker, Mambo Number 5, is it? Yeah, he played that. Simon D's comments about that were quite extraordinary. I can't quite remember. I wish I had a recording of it. Yeah. But that was the last time I heard Simon D.
Yeah.
And he was just so good for such... He peaked very quickly, Simon. He was good for a short period of time, but he wasn't enduring, not like David or Ed.
And it reminds me, actually, of watching some of those old Jukebox Jury episodes with David Jacobs and Pete Murray. And I remember that I saw an episode or clips just a few years ago, and I think they were looking at, it may have been Poetry in Motion, Johnny Tillotson, and they were saying, oh, it'll never be a hit, it's a lot of rubbish. And the songs that they thought were going to be hits ended up, of course, perhaps, you know, disappearing into the ether, and then the songs that they thought actually were pretty good, you know, didn't stand a chance. But I think you're right that there was something also about that live radio, the round table. I know Mike Reed took it forward on Radio 1 in the 80s, because it was a chance for the people who were themselves either performers or fellow presenters, who had a chance really to sort of give their own take and make those comparisons maybe with the music and the change in music over the decades. So it was always interesting, not just because of what they thought about the music, but about their own particular...
Interesting. I won't name names, but, you know, the regular presenters were on there, you know, predicting what they thought they'd come up with a track or a record that they were predicting would be a hit. Now, Johnny Walker was always very good at it. He wouldn't necessarily come up with something that was going to be a hit, but an enduring sound, something which we probably listen to now. And as I say, I won't name names, but there were some people that you just felt that their musical knowledge or their interest in music was extremely peripheral. And it kind of, when you look back upon it now, but then as you say, like Jukebox Jury, they usually got it wrong, you know, they'd think something was going to be a hit and it wasn't. And I think that's possibly a little bit unfair when you listen to recordings. I mean, and this isn't a criticism of Tony Blackburn at all, because there's an awful lot of Tony Blackburn's early radio shows that still exist. And, you know, that's a chart-bound sound and all these kind of things that he used to say in those days. Most of the time, he would kind of get it wrong. But you can't blame people for that. It's a bit like me. I love horse racing. I get it wrong far more often than I get it right. It is very difficult, isn't it? It is a bit of a gamble, and it's also, you never quite know. And I think an awful lot of good stuff that should have been hits has been lost. Yeah. Equally as an awful lot of rubbish has probably made it when it shouldn't have done. So yeah. That's life, isn't it? Yeah.
But it sounds, talking to you, Noel, as though... Well, I referred to you earlier as a curator, but, you know, your work, it sounds like you're an archivist, because you're doing it daily, you know, every day that David Hamilton puts out a programme from 12 till 2 on Boom Radio, within hours, you've put up not just the show, which in itself is an achievement and a commitment, but also a synopsis with a take, and a very witty as well, you know, as you talk through the different songs and you form segues based in part on what David Hamilton himself says in the show, but also your own take on it. But have you always done that? I mean, do you have stuff going back to your childhood where you would write down the shows and the presenters and the music that you're listening to?
No, I have to confess that I haven't, and I do wish that I am a frustrated journalist, and I think probably I would have made a very good journalist. I've made other choices in my life as my life has gone along, and I thank David in a way, not that David doesn't ask me to do anything, you know, he puts no demand on me whatsoever. Everything that I do comes purely from my own volition. It's what I want to do, and he loves what I do and appreciates it, and I think that's a great arrangement. I think it wouldn't work in any other way, and I just felt when he started to do this radio show that I couldn't help but feel that each show, I know they don't necessarily plan it. George, Paul Robey, who is the guy who digs out all the music for the Boom shows. I mean, we're not just talking David's, we're talking every show there. And it's incredible what he comes up with. It's on the par with the sort of music that used to come out of primetime radio, which I felt was the nearest thing to Boom in terms of a forerunner there. As I say, Paul Robey must work 26 hours a day coming up with the stuff that he comes up with, and the sounds that he comes up with are quite incredible. But it's not just the pre-planning that comes from him. Every time I listen to one of David's shows, I can't help it. It kind of just flows, and I build up a story about, and I'm sure that's not what they intended to do, But I do, and I just feel that, yeah, I need to throw in a little witticism here or witticism there. Because I know David is somebody with a very, very good sense of humour. And the way that, you know, he thinks along the same lines as me, really, in the way that he reacts to and deals with things. And if he misses something that I think he should have said, I'll probably throw it in. But 9 times out of 10, he doesn't. I kind of know he's going to say it. I know in the next link he's going to say it. So we are kind of so close in our thinking.
I remember always listening to, you know, Sarah Kennedy apparently would say that, you know, the secret to radio success is that you have in your mind, not necessarily a particular individual, but you imagine that you're talking to one person, not necessarily a particular gender or occupation or age, but you've got one person in your head and you're having a conversation with that person. And of course, there's something very confessional about radio. I think Sarah Kennedy was actually brilliant in the morning. Sometimes, of course, she would get a bit carried away and she'd get into a bit of trouble sometimes for saying things that maybe were slightly, you know, off beam, and she'd sort of get carried away in her own thoughts. But that also, that was the joy of live radio. But I wonder with David, in some ways, you're his ideal listener because you're somebody who makes a point of listening. David, in a way, is going to, not that he needs to up his game, but in a way, because he knows that you're listening, in a way, in doing the programme, everything that he says, he kind of knows what works. He knows that there's an audience for that. And in a way, it kind of is a good synchronicity.
Yeah, I think I'm a kind of sounding board. I think I represent, if you like, the filter that he's aiming at. And I think he probably wonders in my summing up of each show what bits I'm going to pick up on. And he'd probably think, oh, well, I think Noel will pick up on this. I think he probably does go through his mind. I don't know. But I do know that he reads it every day. He doesn't comment every day to me. But that's one of the joys, again, with David. There's no kind of, you know, I don't feel that he's obliged to send me an email every day and tell me that I've said this or I've done that. He never corrects anything that I've said. At the same time, if there's something he particularly picks up on, he will come back to me. And he will normally tell me, so I'm going to, your prose was so wonderful yesterday, I'm going to mention it on the show tomorrow, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's one where I called his show The Lunch Lounge, Shay Diddy, you know, and which I do, you know, I say, I make this little kind of, I build up this little picture of David coming in on a flying trapeze in a leopard skin leotard or wearing his red crocodile skin shoes because it's got something to do with the opening shots of Saturday Night Fever or whatever. I use a lot of imagination, but you know, the funny thing is I can't write for myself. If somebody said sit down and compose, I could when I was younger, but these days if somebody said sit down and write something imaginative out of your own mind, I'd sit there for hours with a, you know, with a pen and not, well, it's not a pen anymore, but you know, I'd just have, what do they call it, writer's cramp or whatever it is. But yet, the minute I've got something that I can write about, then that's it, off I go. And yeah, I have amazed myself sometimes with some of the stuff. I mean, I was very pleased with something I came out with last week, which he happened to mention Jimmy Yell during the course of the show. I can't even remember really what the connection was, but I think he did an impression of Jimmy as well. So I did, when I got to the end of the summing up, I sort of said, well, that's Judy, I'm going to say TTFN. What's the recipe? It's the next DJ, yeah. Rondo. I put 5 more hot shots, yeah. You know, which, you know, hot shots, hot cakes, whatever, you know, because we've been talking about hot shots through the course of the write-up. And he put on last week, he put one particular record on. It was the Drifters with Sister and Brother, which I've always thought is a wonderful, wonderful record. And it so much sums up the David Hamilton show that we knew on Radio 1. It was the kind of thing that he would have played. It was the Drifters, which was a group, obviously, that were very much, you know, at the top of their game at the time. And also they were over here in this country, although an American group, but they were very much Anglophiles, you know, they would tour the country all the time. And yeah, that's a great, great. And when Primetime came along, they played that record as well. There were so many records from the 1970s that kind of got lost in time, when we, particularly when we came to the 90s and the early 2000s. And they were, another one is that he played for my daughter, because when he came to my daughter's christening, I actually named, this is sad really, but I it's not that it is or it isn't, but I which is one of the things my sister wrote about in her column, you know, her eccentric brother. But my daughter, who was very much a kind of autumn crocus, I was 46 when she was born, and very much unexpected. My wife and I had been trying for years to have children, and we kind of could give it up hope, and she came along. And anyway, I decided to name her Eleanor Louise Hamilton Tyrrell. And so David came along to the christening, and he made a speech. And I also asked him to play a record, which was by the Intruders, which is a Motown number, Wind Plays in the Show. My baby, she's a winner. And all these old ladies sat there. Well, he played this record. David and I got it, but nobody else did. It was a terrible choice, really. But ever since then, on numerous occasions, David has played for me and Ellie. And he did it only last Friday, The Intruders.
One thing, Noel, in talking to you, I mean, I said this before when we were talking a week ago, that you have a very obvious to me radio voice. And is that a dream that you ever had? Because obviously you talk so passionately about others, but could you ever, you know, if David ever one day, you know, wasn't able to present his show, could you ever see yourself presenting a radio programme?
Well, very much so. I could see myself presenting a radio programme. One of the problems that I have, though, is very different. I'm so different to David. And funnily enough, I was watching some tapes today of my father that he made when he was doing some recordings for an organization called Satellite Information Services, to do with horse racing. And he couldn't do it live. He had a problem with live and became self-conscious. And that, unfortunately, is something that I've inherited. So I'm not sure I'd be very good at live radio. I'm very good, you know, and the written word, and that would be the only thing that I think would prevent me from saying that yes, I could do that job. Yes, of course I could if it was scripted. That's not radio, is it? It's not scripted.
But in a way, it's the best of both worlds, because your passion for radio is palpable, but what you're doing is curating the work of presenters dear to you, and you're channeling that. And you know, I mean, one of my regrets, I suppose I always did write this down, I've always kept a diary, so I do have records of, you know, Radio 1 road shows and all sorts of different sort of, you know, the charts on a Sunday, but there is something precious about that, because on the one hand, today everything's online, it's very easy. If you want information, you know, why would you write the charts down today? Because you can just print it off, you get it on your phone. But there is something about a moment in time, and I think that what you're doing is also conveying why it impacts on you. It's interesting that you say that you'd have writer's block if you were writing about yourself, but you found your muse. And just as David uses you as a sounding board, when you listen to David, the enthusiasm is sparked and you have no difficulty channeling that. And what, I mean, I suppose I do something similar with the interviews, and obviously I'll put a summary together, a synopsis of the highlights of what somebody talks about. But you do it with a daily radio show. And I think that is something that in decades to come, people will see that as a very important repository, because otherwise it could be a case of why this presenter, what's so important about David Hamilton? But you convey that and you give a reason for listening and why people should listen, and you know, and what you were saying about the leotard and the, you know, so on, you know, a moment ago, you're probably going to put the listening figures up by millions now, but you're actually giving people a reason to see why radio, which perhaps isn't as big as it was a few decades ago, or there are more choices and alternatives there, a reason to tune in.
I think that's one of the things about radio, though, isn't it? I mean, we've all, you know, enjoyed listening to radio plays. I mean, radio plays are so much better than television plays, really, because you build the pictures in your imagination. And the same when you read a book, and I've never been a great reader of books. I'm sad to say, I don't know why I struggle with reading books. And yet I envy people who do, and I have read books in my time. And when occasionally when I do get through a book and I look back upon it, I think, well, I really enjoyed that experience. And then particularly if they make a movie of that book, the movie never, never ever adds up to what you've read in the book. But in terms of radio plays, spent most of my life driving around the country on long journeys and listening to radio shows. And you kind of, you build the story in your own mind. And I think that's the great thing about radio. And I think that's one of the things that I do with David's shows is that I immediately kind of build up pictures in my own mind. And I want to, you know, put those down and just change it from what is... You have, it's two-dimensional radio, but that third dimension is in your imagination. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to beat that because your own vision of how it should be is totally unique. And it gives that very, very special picture. And I think that's why radio works. I think radio, I think, you know, if you strip everything away, we'll still have radio. I think radio will far outlive television if there's ever a chance for radio to do so. And then people say, okay, well, the young people of today, they don't listen to radio. Well, okay, so they're now into YouTube. But if those pictures are taken away, it probably will never happen, but if those pictures were taken away, they would still have those two dimensions of radio. It's like the black and white or even just television that we've come to, that is again two-dimensional, it's not three-dimensional, but it is fed to you, whereas radio, of course, it goes into your ears, it's not something you visualize, you have to mentally visualize it.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly put, because I remember Chris Evans at an award show once being asked, what is the future of television? Because this was the time when he was doing a lot of TV work, and he said, radio. And there was a silence, and thought, ooh, that's not the answer we were expecting. But there is something about the power of radio, because... You know, I always found that when I was at school in the playground, we'd always be talking about the charts and what, you know, what had been number one the night before. And, you know, on the Monday, we'd all be talking about what we'd listen to on the breakfast show, etc. But that's the thing, because we were all doing different things, or maybe the same thing, but in different places, all getting ready for school. Some people going by taxi or by car or by bus, and some people walking. But in different ways, radio was there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the other great thing about radio is you can get on with your life and listen to the radio at the same time. With television, you've actually got to take the time to sit down and watch it. Yeah. And again, television is responsible for us all being grossly obese and, you know, couch potatoes. Radio isn't, because we can do radio on the move, you know, but we can't with television. It's a wonderful medium, radio. It really is. It's quite astonishing, the benefits and joy of radio compared to, I mean, we all love television, of course we do. But at the end of the day, radio is, it just has so many ingredients to it that are totally unique to it. And I suppose it's probably just, it kind of goes back to what would have happened before we had radio. We'd be listening to our elders, the former generations who would be telling us about, that's how things were carried down from generation to generation, long before people could write things down. It's just audibility, isn't it, really? It's the listening process. And all that radio has done is that it's allowed us to go out to a much, much greater audience. Yeah. But no, radio, it's just incredible. Really. I am a radio person. I've got like, I would say well over 2,000 radio shows, some of which I've recorded myself. I was very, very fortunate in that about 20 years ago, I came across a guy through eBay who had gone to a local rubbish dump here in Bournemouth, and he'd found a huge amount of old reel-to-reel tapes, and a vast amount of the radio archive that I've got has come from him.
Yeah.
But I've accumulated, I've paid for it. I've paid enormous amounts of money sometimes. Nowadays, things are a bit different. Now we've got Mixcloud and, you know, we can share. And when that came along, the ability to actually share all this material. You know, before that, people were kind of, you know, slightly, oh, well, I've got this, I'll swap you this, and I'll swap you that. I don't like that, because I think everybody wants should have it. I think it should be out there. I also have a YouTube presence. I'm Rodrigo de Triano on YouTube, and most of it is horse racing, which is another passion. But I put a huge amount of stuff out on that. And every day I'm thinking to myself, what can I put on YouTube? I'm not putting quite so much out now. There's an awful lot of material that I should be putting out for people to enjoy on retro radio or whatever. Unfortunately, time doesn't permit because I'm having to do David's show on it, which is quite time consuming. But don't get me wrong. If I couldn't do it, I'd feel bereft. You know, it's something which drives me. I have to do it. If I go away for a few days, I found other people who will do it for me, or I store it all up when I get back. First thing I have to do is get it out.
No, I think you're right, because some things, if you're paid to do them, I mean, I do a lot of stuff with film as well, and, you know, sometimes going to see a film by choice is a wonderful thing, and you can see the same film as many times as you like, and you can write a review or not write a review. But if somebody says, oh, you have to do this, you have to go to this film festival, you have to watch four films a day, then the passion, the fun is taken out of it, because then actually you're doing it for somebody else, and if you're doing something because you believe in it and you want to do it, then actually it actually has a wonderful counterpart and can be something that can be a counterpoint actually to the rest of your life. Because you're doing that in a way that you're channeling all your creativity and productivity into something that maybe in your job a different side of you is harnessed.
I think with YouTube, when they said to me, well, when you get 1,000 subscribers, you know, you can start to charge, and I don't want to do that. Yeah. But then I have these copyright issues as well, because I put stuff on there and they say, oh, it's been blocked for this, or you can't monetize. I'm not interested in monetizing it. Yeah. I'm not doing it to make money. I'm not, you know, I'm doing it because I want to share it. I want to share it with other people who will enjoy it. It's not, I think you know where I'm coming from, Chris.
It's elemental. I mean, yeah. People say to me sometimes, you know, oh, you put film reviews out for free on Facebook. It's like, yeah, but to be honest with you, it's a labor of love. If I spend an evening at the cinema, I want to have, same with radio as well, I want a concretization of that. And if I can share it with somebody, it just takes one person to read it, and my job is done.
Yeah, that's right.
And my very last question, Noel, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's... Very good question, an interesting question. I am very much a looking back person, but I wouldn't disregard the looking forward either. But yes, I do have to say I like things that have passed. My mother used to say to me, you were born 50 years after your time. And, you know, the 20th century, to me, there were parts of the 20th century, you know, which were... I'm so sorry I missed the 1920s and the 1930s. I don't think I particularly wanted to go through the war, but, you know. And, yeah, I love the music of the 1930s. The old Alan Dell dance band days. I used to love that. Malcolm Laycock took on that mantle later on. When it comes to films, I don't particularly like anything that's made after about 1970, preferably in black and white and preferably British. And those old British movie stars, you know, I just know so many. I'm so deeply steeped in that. You know, that's a whole other subject. Yeah, I mean, I've got so many diverse interests, but most of them are, I'm afraid, entrenched in the past. But that's not to say that the future isn't there for me too. Particularly, I've got, you know, my stepson is 18. He's going to university. Hopefully in a few weeks' time, my daughter is 15, year 11. Of course, I think about the future and I care about the future. And I'm very fortunate in that in my children, I think that they are going to also care about the future. And actually, I don't feel slightly guilty that probably my generation, the ones before, but then we didn't know that quite the damage that maybe that we were doing. I don't wish to get kind of serious about these things, but at the end of the day, of course, we we do have to think about that. But equally, I do dislike the kind of over PC attitude about what was created in earlier times. Times have moved on, and those pieces and those programs and those films, they were of their time. And I think we should leave them in their time and not judge them in today's world. We need to judge them for the times that they were made. And not that I believe in any way about racism or cruelty or unpleasantness towards anybody else, of course, those kind of things. But I think there are certain levels of humor now that people are maybe, things like Benny Hill. I mean, Benny Hill was Benny Hill. I know we look back upon it now and it doesn't seem quite right, doesn't sit quite right. But on the other hand, it is what it is. You don't have to watch it if you don't want to. That's just my take on it.
I have to say, Noel, this has been phenomenally good to meet you, because what you've done in the last hour is given me so much hope, because the number of times when I'll post maybe on Facebook about my radio interests or conversations with people, and I have to explain who the presenters are, I sometimes think, well, you know, I've got these interests that have followed me through my life, and you don't always get a chance to share them. They seem to be a bit niche. You know, people of my age, my generation, when I was at university in the 90s, I was listening to Radio 2 every day. Most people I knew didn't listen. And in a way, that gave me the incentive to listen even more, because I thought, well, I'm doing something that, you know, no one else is doing. So if I'm not doing it, who's going to do it?
The sheep that walks alone, yeah.
Yeah. but it shows that there is a constituency out there. And as I say, I'm completely awestruck by the volume that you put out and the conscientiousness and assiduousness of it.
The thing is that most of the people that I discuss this matter with are of your generation. You're kind of 10, 15 years younger than I am. A guy called Stuart Busby, who I haven't spoken to Stuart for a while, but I think he's about in his mid-40s to late-40s, I'm not sure. But they're a generation kind of, again, behind. But the fact is that you know about Ed Stewart, you know about David Hamilton, you know about Jimmy Young, who weren't really your generation, but they were clearly, they got into your psyche, you know. I think you recognise them as being... And equally, why should the film stars of the 40s and 50s and 60s get into my side? But they were, and they still, there's a Talking Pictures TV that run those movies now. And I don't watch anything else but Talking Pictures TV. Oh, I'm sorry, but I don't, because I just love watching that stuff. It's so well made, and it's so... You know, the plots are good. They don't seem dated at all. You know, and it's clean and it's wholesome. I'm starting to talk like the PC Brigade, but no, I don't. You know, I still respect things for the time that they were made and the way that people spoke. I mean, I was watching a Steptoe thing. It was only a weekend, and all of a sudden they were saying something and the word, whatever the word was, had been silenced out. I mean, I think there are certain words, obviously, that we wouldn't use now. In generally speaking, I think it's a little bit extreme.
Noel, I have to say that this has been such a pleasure, and I'm so grateful to you for giving up your time. So thank you for being my guest this week.
My pleasure too, Chris. And it, as I say, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.